Last Sunday evening, we returned to the book of Psalms, and our psalm this evening is Psalm 54. And I want to suggest to you that the key phrase then in this psalm is contained in verse 3. Now, notice first of all that verses 5 and 7 both refer to my enemies. So, as is so often the case in the book of Psalms, enemies are causing problems here. But it's only in verse 3 that the enemies are actually described. In other parts of the psalm, they are assumed, but in verse 3, the enemies are described. And it's a very restrained description that we're given there in verse 3. People have this idea, don't they, that the psalms are very vitriolic, that these authors wrote about their enemies in such a way that Donald Trump's most belligerent tweets look quite mild-mannered by comparison. But David here can't be accused of that. His description of his enemies there in verse 3 is, as I say, very restrained. He doesn't let rip about what nasty pieces of work they are. There's that first line of the verse where, as you can see from your footnote, there's some uncertainty as to what exactly is being said. In the second line, he uses a reasonably strong adjective, ruthless men, he calls them, but he's still hardly letting himself go. And then the third line is a very thoughtful, reflective one. He's not really denouncing these enemies at all in that third line of verse 3. He's analysing them. He's saying this is what their real problem is. They do not set God before themselves. And that's the phrase I was referring to a moment ago. The phrase I described as the key one in this psalm. They do not set God before themselves. Think about that. He's not saying that these enemies of his are idol-worshipping pagans. He's not saying that they are irreligious folk who deny the central truths pertaining to the living God. That's not the kind of people they are. It seems reasonable enough, I think, to take the historical background we're given in the words above the psalm at face value. Those words aren't spirit-inspired, they aren't infallible, but on this occasion they seem to provide a very credible setting for this psalm. That's why I read to you earlier on from the historical episode to which they refer, 1 Samuel chapter 23. And taking that historical background at face value then means that the enemies in this psalm are the Ziphites. Now, the Ziphites are people of the tribe of Judah. Ziph was a town within the territory of Judah. So the Ziphites were from that tribe, which means that almost certainly these Ziphites would nominally have been Yahweh people. That is, they would have kept Yahweh's festivals and administered Yahweh's rite of circumcision to their children and called themselves worshippers of Yahweh. But you see, the whole thing was skin deep for these Ziphites. It was superficial. Their allegiance to Yahweh didn't stop them playing the world's political games, operating by the world's rules of engagement, so that when David is hiding among them and they've got to choose between loyalty to David and loyalty to Saul, they assess these two men, David and Saul, in the way that any old Joe Bloggs on the street would do so. Saul looks like a king with clout and authority. David, on the other hand, looks like a pathetic loser hiding away in remote places, a hair's breadth from capture and certain death. Saul, therefore, is in a better position to reward our loyalty than David is. We'll go with Saul. That's how they think. They think in terms of appearances and in terms of self-interest. They don't think in terms of Yahweh's will. They don't take into account Yahweh's promise that David will be king. They don't think, well, if Yahweh has chosen David as the next king, then David will be the next king regardless of how much of a loser he may currently appear. They don't think, actually, if David is Yahweh's chosen king, then being loyal to him is just the right thing to do, irrespective of whether or not we are ever rewarded for that loyalty. No, such considerations aren't even on the Ziphites' radar. They have this formal adherence to Yahweh, I'm saying, but they think exactly the way that the world thinks. Actually, you still get people like that. And on Sundays, they go to church and sing hymns and look very Christian. And then Monday to Friday in the workplace, they play the same political games that their non-Christian colleagues do, and are driven by the same ambitions to be rich and successful that their non-Christian colleagues are driven by. Their Christianity is skin deep, it's superficial, it doesn't affect their lives as a whole. And I'm saying that's the kind of thing David has in mind then when he speaks of these Ziphites as not setting God before themselves. He means that they haven't really brought God into the center of their lives, these people. God is just this cold, distant concept to them. They pay lip service to him, but it doesn't go deeper than that. Now, you might be thinking, well, this is all very interesting, Dan. If anyone ever stops me in the street and says, please tell me all about the Ziphites, because I just can't get to sleep because I'm puzzling so much about the Ziphites, I'll be able to tell them now a bit about these people. But why are you saying that that description of them there in verse 3 is the key phrase in the whole psalm? You might be wondering that. Well, this is why I'm saying that. Because I think that what David is doing in the other 6 verses is providing a model of the opposite. He's showing what it is to set God before oneself. And that's how I want to approach then the rest of this psalm this evening. I want us to see the psalm as essentially answering this question. What's the difference between nominal adherence to the God of the Bible, of the kind that characterized the Ziphites? What's the difference between that and truly setting God before oneself? What's the difference? And I want to suggest in the rest of the time we have that setting God before oneself makes a huge difference in at least 3 areas. So first of all, it changes how you relate to God. It changes how you relate to God. And this is verses 1 and 2. What are verses 1 and 2? Well, in a word, prayer. Prayer. David is addressing God there. And that simple fact then is a massive indication that a person has set God before him or herself. Such a person relates to God by way of prayer. He or she prays. The person who simply believes in God doesn't pray. That person might occasionally or even diligently say his prayers, say her prayers, but it's a pure religious rite done either as a means of personal therapy for its calming benefits or out of some kind of superstitious concern that bad things might happen if this lucky charm is omitted. But either way, it isn't relating to God by way of prayer. I quoted Benjamin Warfield this morning. Listen to Benjamin Warfield again in a completely different connection. He writes this: "The sacred idea of prayer is, to put it sharply, communion with God, the meeting of the soul with God and the holding of converse with him. Perhaps we would best define it as conscious intercourse or communion with God." And then he continues in this way, very strikingly. He says, "It is impossible to conceive of a praying man, therefore, as destitute of grace," i.e. not a Christian. He says, "Dr. Charles Hodge used to startle us by declaring that no praying soul ever was lost. It seemed to us a hard saying. But then he says, our difficulty was that we did not conceive praying purely enough. We can, no doubt, go through the motions of prayer and not be saved souls. Our Saviour tells us of those who love to pray on the street corners and in the synagogues to be seen of men. But when we really pray, we are actually in enjoyment of communion with God. And is not communion with God salvation? So I'm saying then that the person who has set God before him or herself is different from the mere nominal believer in God. In this area, the person relates to God by way of prayer. The person enjoys that communion with God in prayer that Warfield describes so eloquently there, and that David is clearly experiencing here in these opening two verses. By the way, David's sense of access into God's immediate presence is remarkable here, isn't it? I mean, David doesn't have the text with which I began our service this evening. Ephesians 2:18, for through him, that is Christ, we have access in one spirit to the Father. David doesn't have that text. David can't spell out how the roles of Christ and the Spirit mean we can boldly approach the Father. He can't spell that out. And yet he seems to understand intuitively what he can't explain theologically. He speaks of God as giving ear, verse 2, to the words of my mouth. Such a direct concept of prayer, direct audience with God. He gives ear. My words fall, as it were, right into the ear of God, David is saying. If David, without Ephesians 2:18, could revel in his access to God, how much more should we, knowing much more about that access, revel in our access to God's immediate presence? But my question then, in relation to this first point this evening, is this: are you someone then who has set God before you? Is that evident in that you pray? Is it evident in that you pray? You pray in the sense we've defined it this evening. You engage meaningfully and earnestly with a God you believe is real and personal and attentive to your voice. The Ziphites and their modern counterparts know nothing of that. Many who crowd into churches on a Sunday morning know nothing of that. Do you know something of that? Have you set God before you? Is it evident in that you pray? So, setting God before oneself then, it changes, first of all, how you relate to God. But then secondly, it changes how you think of God. It changes how you think of God. And this is verses 4 and 5. And in a word then, if you are one of these people we are talking about tonight, if you are someone who has set God before you, the way the Ziphites hadn't, the way David had, then you think of him as relevant. You think of God as relevant. That is deeply relevant to your life. That's what comes across in verses 4 and 5. And there's a kind of escalation of that concept as these two verses unfold. So notice, first of all, God is involved. God is involved. Verse 4, behold, God is my helper, David says. And we need to remember David's context here. He's not saying this while worshipping in the tabernacle. He's not saying this while sitting on his favorite chair in the corner of his study where he always enjoys his quiet times. He's saying this while hiding among the rocks in some desolate location, dirty and sweaty and smelly, planning elaborate strategies as to how to avoid his pursuers. And yet you see, David doesn't think of God as removed from all that because it's all so earthy. No, he sees God as involved. involved in the nitty-gritty practicalities of hiding from one's enemies. And this is a mark then of those who have set God before them. They think of God as involved, not distant and remote, but involved. In that quote from Warfield earlier, Charles Hodge was mentioned, and I'm going to quote now from Hodge's recollections of his childhood. And this is what Charles Hodge then said about his own childhood. He said, "As far back as I can remember, I had the habit of thanking God for everything I received and asking him for everything I wanted. If I lost a book or any of my playthings, I prayed that I might find it. I prayed walking along the streets, in school and out of school, whether playing or studying. I did not do this in obedience to any prescribed rule. It seemed natural. I thought of God as an everywhere present being full of kindness and love." And Hodge goes on to say how that conviction never left him as he grew older and older. And that then is how those who have set God before themselves think of him, involved in the nitty-gritty, the practicalities. Do you think of God like that? Involved in your situation tomorrow, whether that be at home as you're just doing ordinary chores, whether that be at work as you're sitting in front of a computer screen, whether it be as you're at school learning. God is involved there, involved in your situation, involved in that as much as he's involved in this. It's a wonderful mindset to have. God is my helper. He's not just this God with whom I meet in worship services and quiet times, but this God who is there and involved in all the nooks and crannies of my daily life. So God is involved. Secondly, God is sovereign. God is sovereign because David continues, "The Lord is the upholder of my life." And again, remember the context in which David is saying this. And clearly then his attitude is not that his life is dependent on him keeping one step ahead of people like Saul and the Ziphites who hate him and are after him. No, his life is dependent on the one who upholds it, that is God, the sovereign God. It's God who decides whether David lives or whether he dies. It's not Saul, it's not the Ziphites, it's not his enemies, it's God. It's God who is in control of David's life and how long that life lasts. And again, that's a mark then of those who have set God before them. They think of God as involved in the nitty-gritty, but also as sovereign over all the details of life. Sovereign over its beginning point and its end point and every point in between. My fate doesn't lie in the hands of a virus and whether or not it will catch me. My fate lies in the hands of the one who has given me every breath I have breathed throughout my life until this very moment. Plagues and deaths around me fly till he bids, I cannot die. Not a single shaft can hit till the God of love sees fit. What a word for us in these times when people are panicking and so stressed and concerned. The Lord is the upholder of my life. And until he stops upholding it, my life will continue running. And only when he stops upholding it will it cease to run. That's how those who have set God before themselves think. They think of him as involved. They think of him as sovereign. And then a third thing, God is pledged. God is involved, God is sovereign, God is pledged. the end of verse 5. He says in the beginning of verse 5, he will return the evil to my enemies, then in your faithfulness put an end to them. That's strong language. That's covenant language. That word faithfulness, it's a word that is used in connection with God's promises and God's covenant pledges. It assumes that God has pledged himself to something. And the point here is then that God had pledged himself to put David on the throne of Israel. He had promised that. And so implicit in that is the removal of those who are trying to stop David getting to the throne of Israel. And that's then how David can say, in your faithfulness, put an end to these enemies who are trying to obstruct your promises. In your faithfulness to your pledges to me, deal with these enemies. And again then, Ziphites don't claim promises and pledges that God has made to them. But those who have set God before them, they see God as involved, as sovereign, but also as a God who has pledged himself to all sorts of things. Not in our case, putting us on the throne of Israel, of course, but he has pledged himself to forgive my sins, and I may hold him to that. I may go to him tonight as I put my head on my pillow and as I confess today's sins, and I may hold him to forgiving those sins because he's pledged himself to that. He's pledged himself to change my character. And at times when I feel that that's going so slowly, and there are still so many indications of that impulse to sin in me that we considered this morning, I can hold him to this. God, you've pledged yourself to change me from glory into glory, to conform me to the likeness of my elder brother. God, do this. Sanctify me through and through, in Paul's language. He's pledged to get me to heaven. And at times when I'm doubting that I'm going to ever see that new world, and I'm going to be there with the saints of God from all the ages, and I'm going to put my arms around the Lord Jesus Christ, I can hold him to it. You've pledged this, God. And so I'm saying these are three ways. Well, one basic way that those who have set God before them think about God, they think of him as relevant. And relevant in this escalating way. He's involved in the nitty-gritty, 9 to 5, Monday to Saturday, as well as Sunday. He's sovereign. He controls my every breath, the every beating of my heart. And he's pledged. He's made specific, concrete promises to me that I can hold him to. This God is involved. Do you think about God in that way? Do you think of him as relevant, not distant, remote, just there, a concept, a theological construct, but a God who's relevant to life? It's a mark of those who have set God before themselves. So it changes how you relate to God. It changes how you think about God. But then, thirdly, when you set God before yourself, it changes how you feel about God. It changes how you feel about God. And this is verses 6 and 7. And verses 6 and 7 then, at first sight, it seems as though there's been a chronological leap here. And now kind of the Ziphites have been dealt with, and there's been some deliverance kind of between verse 5 and verse 6. I'm not sure that's the case. I think this comment by one of the commentators may well be closer to the truth. He says, in his confident assurance of a favorable issue, that's a favorable outcome, he speaks of it, though future, as already past. In his confident assurance of a favorable outcome, he speaks of it, though future, as already past. In other words, he's confident that God will deal with these Ziphites. That these people who are siding with Saul, obstructing David's path to the throne, they will one day be his subjects. That's the triumph that he refers to at the end of verse 7. One day he will be their king. The one who's presently hiding in their rocky places, he will one day be their king. That's the triumph that David foresees at the end of verse 7. But what interests me here is this, that David could really go to town, couldn't he? Imagining that moment, that day that's coming when he will be actually on Israel's throne, and these Ziphites who set themselves against him, they will be his subjects. David could really go to town on how wonderful that will be. What he's going to say to them, the speech he's going to throw in their faces on that day. He could imagine that and relish every angle of that coming scene a few years down the line. But that's not what we see here, is it? Rather, his joy here in these last two verses isn't so much in the triumph that he's going to experience. He mentions that, but his joy isn't so much in the triumph he's going to experience as it's in the one who's going to bring that triumph about. It's God-centered joy, isn't it? God-focused joy. With a free will offering. That's an offering that's not something compulsory from your law, but with an offering I voluntarily brought, I will sacrifice to you. I will give thanks to your name, O Yahweh, for it is good. He's reveling not so much in the triumph God is going to give him as in the God who's going to give it to him. And this then is another manifestation that someone has set God before them. When they feel gratitude and joy in God, not supremely in his gifts, but in God himself. Yes, to some extent in his gifts, it's right, isn't it, that we feel joy in the gifts that God lavishes upon us. But it's a sign that someone has set God before them when they look beyond God's gifts and find their supreme emotional satisfaction, not in them, but in the giver of them. And that's what we see with David here. He's going to triumph over the Ziphites and everyone else who's trying to stop him getting to the throne. One day, they will look silly as he has the crown on his head. But David's not relishing that in itself. David is just overwhelmed with the God who's doing that for him. His ultimate emotional satisfaction is in God, not in God's gifts. And again, it's something to think about in relation to ourselves. Is that also true of us? And so people who have set God before themselves, unlike the Ziphites, but like David, they are people who relate to God in an intimate way through prayer. They're people who think about God as relevant. And they're people who feel deeply, emotionally about God, joy and gratitude toward him. And just one other thought as we close. It's interesting that this phrase, this language of setting God before oneself, it's not unique to this psalm. In fact, we sang very similar language a few minutes ago in Psalm 16. You may recall how the psalmist there in verse 8, he says, "I have set the Lord always before me." And remember I said that That is ultimately Jesus speaking. The person who is saying in that verse, I have set God before me. I have brought God into the very center of my life. It's Jesus who's saying that. So that when we do this, we are not merely following in the footsteps of David, although that's an honorable path to walk. But more than that, we are following in the footsteps of our Lord Jesus. This is the principle out of which he lived his life. He'd set God before him. God wasn't remote and distant to Jesus. He wasn't just formally, nominally, outwardly a Yahweh person. But God was at the center of everything for Jesus. I have set him before me. And so, with the help of the Spirit who helped Jesus to achieve that, may we increasingly, this week and the week beyond and the week beyond that, and as we go through our lives, may we increasingly set God before us. Amen.